Somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout, but there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck!
I only got one thing to say to you. Strike this mother out.
2-2. He got a perfect game. Everyone done by the king.
Hey, you. Are you right there, Apple?
Took away a game-tying home run for Manny Ramirez.
That's my thing, fellas.
We will see you tomorrow night.
Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for visiting us this evening.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Mudville Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
I'm your other host, Brody Stout.
And we are joined today by a recurring guest you know very well. This is Molly Thomas. She is joining the Three Timers Club on the podcast. It is now just you, Molly, and Brody's brother, Morgan. So you're joining very elite company. Thank you for coming onto the pod today. We're always very happy to have you.
Thank you. It's good to be the one like non-nepotism hire, I guess.
I'm going to tell Morgan you said that. He earned that. He got it on merit by being right down the hallway when we were recording.
Classic Nepo baby Morgan. Last time we had you on the pod was, I believe it was June at this point. We were discussing a very tough stretch that the Philadelphia Phillies were going through at the time. And you had also just watched a hometown bad vibes double feature of I Saw the TV Glow, the new film this year from Jane Scheinbrunn, and Peter Bogdanovich's The Last Picture Show, which I found to be a very interesting pairing. Turns out time is a flat circle because we're actually doing something very, very similar today. I'm going to give you a chance to vent about another struggling Philadelphia team, although this time it might be actually 10 times worse because the 76ers are in the midst of a season from hell. We're also going to go in depth into two different movies today, one of which I watched earlier in the year. It came out on YouTube a few months ago after a brief run at a few like smaller festivals. And then another film that had been a blind spot of mine for a very long time, and I was really happy to watch this week. Those two films are going to be Connor O'Malley's Rap World and Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. I'm very happy that you brought these movies to the pod. Could you say a little bit about what inspired you to pair them with each other?
Yeah, so the thing about Rapwell for me is it's like a movie about guys whose lives objectively suck, and they suck, but they are too stupid to commit suicide. And The Virgin Suicides is a movie about girls who... their lives are so beautiful, and they're so wise, and they're sort of almost like supernaturally beyond their years. And they know so much of the world that they want to leave it. So there's like a perfect mirror image of like gender and like childhood experience.
I love that. That's awesome. We're going to get into all of that more. But before we do that, as our London correspondent, I had to ask you a question that I'm not sure I could ask anybody else in the realm of like the Mudville world. Who the fuck is Robbie Williams? And what is the deal with this ape biopic that is scaring the shit out of me every time I open Twitter?
I'm so glad you asked this because I recently had an extended discussion with one of my group chats about this. Robbie Williams is a huge star in the UK, but one of those things that like doesn't translate. It's like how Pink is really, really famous in Australia. Robbie Williams was in a boy band called Take That. Couldn't name one of their songs, sorry. Just don't have anything there for you. All of his music, I think, objectively kind of bad, but very has hugely cultural staying power to the point where I went to a club and they always play Robbie Williams's Angels when you're leaving, and every British person is singing, and every like American exchange student or expat or someone is making eye contact, because it's not just they don't know the words, they've never heard this song before, and everyone else is into it like it's Mr. Brightside. And this movie is so scary. My best friend Hillary is making me see it. She loves Robbie Williams. It's very weird, and I'm really scared they're going to perform at the Oscars because they have a Best Original Song nomination, And I think that could be really difficult for everyone. I think between Wicked and that, we could have multiple monkey-themed performances at the Oscars, which I just think is, you know, we might not have two female directors nominated. So if we have two monkey performances, it does really kind of send a message about where the industry is. I guess what I'm saying is sorry on behalf of the United Kingdom and everything we've done.
Maybe you leave it to the U.S. to export our culture, because ours is clearly, you know.
Yeah, I don't know that you have to apologize to us. There might be a lot of other people, but I was just totally baffled. I was seeing all week this dichotomy of British people being like, oh, Americans don't know who Robbie Williams is. We're so excited. And then Americans being like, who the fuck is Robbie Williams? And that's exactly how I was feeling. I had never heard that name until I thought this was like an original script about a like ape performer singing original songs. I didn't know it was based on an actual musician even. So I'm letting my...
It's like a Lydia Tarr situation. It's not Lydia Tarr.
I thought Lydia Tarr was a true story.
What if Lydia Tarr was a monkey? That's the real movie. That's what
that's
we need to
that's
see.
That's what we have to make after this. Wow. The only place that I had heard of Robbie Williams in... There's an episode of Ted Lasso where he's supposed to be like the evening entertainment and it's like a really big deal. And I thought that was just a name also. And then they made a joke saying, do you think Adele is available because Robbie Williams isn't? And I was like, wait, so they're using real name. Is he a real guy? Like, I had to look it up. But then he's as massive as he is, I've never heard of him. He's no crossover star, I guess. He's like, I mean, I'm always surprised when Oasis is like, you know, here people only know them for Wonderwall, which like that I think is always shocking to British people.
I love Oasis.
You know, if I talk to them, oh, of course. But like most people only know them for Wonderwall. And I'm like, there are, you know, and they only know, they think of them as a one hit wonder, which I think is very interesting too. But
that is interesting.
The perception of British bands over here can really kind of vary. Robbie Williams didn't make the cut.
The funniest thing I've seen about it is someone saying like, what's the American equivalent? Like what's someone who's really famous in America, but is not famous in the UK. And some girl said Helen Keller. And that is kind of true.
Do you guys not know who Helen Keller is?
She had bangers, but...
I'm telling you that we did not learn about Helen Keller in history in either my school in the UK or my school in Australia. That's not someone we learn about.
To be fair...
That's a good call.
Why did we...
She's not U.S. specific. Because she's just like a famous person. She's just a figure. Like,
why did we have to learn about Helen Keller in school? She didn't do much. She was just
kind of blind. No, she didn't do much. That's why we learned about her. That was the whole thing. She figured out how to do a lot.
It was just like,
not doing much.
Get a load of this lady.
Overcame it. It is weird. There's not a lot of other heartwarming figures that we learn about. I guess maybe there's not many.
Is Helen Keller a heartwarming figure? Who the fuck is Helen Keller now that we're speaking about it?
She was blind and
no, I know that, but like...
They taught her how to speak.
I know what her deal was, but what's her legacy? Like... Did she leave behind a good one?
You got me on a Keller kick. That's not a good idea.
My American ignorance is on display here in terms of this Robbie Williams biopic. So let's talk about something that we Americans do know about, the National Basketball Association. Molly, I will give you the floor here to vent about your Philadelphia 76ers because you guys are in hell. And I have a few notes here, but I'm not sure that my objective take can do your assumed anger justice. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what's been going on in the hoops realm in Philly?
So on May 12th, 2023, I tweeted a screenshot that reads, "This isn't a basketball team, it's a mentally weak terrorist organization." And I captioned that the Philadelphia 76ers. On November 11th this year, I tweeted box breathing while I read the full list of Sixers injuries. Those two things were quote tweeted by me back onto my timeline December 15th, where I clarified this time around, they are a physically weak terrorist organization. And essentially time is a flat circle. We're back where we are, but somehow way worse. It's not kind of a tank situation, but the prospect of anything good happening seems extremely unlikely. It was this thing where we came into the season with the stuff about Joel, the stuff about load management, but there was this really good kind of news story with everything that was happening with Jared McCain. It was so good to like see all his TikToks posted on Twitter and guys being like, he actually is actually really good at basketball, and like it's cool that he's like dunking on dudes while being kind of cool and young and getting to enjoy life. I would give him my knee. I would not at this point give Joel my sinuses. I don't think that's in the cards for me, but it's just demoralizing. We've seen sort of some success with people shaving their heads in Philadelphia sports. So Nick Sirianni obviously shaved his head, and the Eagles are on kind of a generational run right now. Nick Castellanos has shaved his head in the offseason, and I've said we should be shaving Nick's heads until we have success, or Nick Nurse may be getting sort of non-consensually shaved in the next few weeks. But I think even that would not save this season. I think shut it down. All the stuff at the stadium is a horrible distraction on top of that as well. I'm just kind of an NBA general fan now. I'm kind of like that picture, I think. Oh my gosh, who is it?
Rob Lowe in the NFL hat. Yeah.
Rob Lowe in the NFL hat. Watching the NBA, where I'm like, I just want to see some good sports. I actually no longer care about any of the teams or any of the people, and none of them have identities to me.
You just want to see some good fucking tennis.
I just want to see some good fucking tennis.
Well, I talked about the Embiid situation a couple of weeks ago just because it seems like so strange that he's basically eternally playing like 50 games per year now, like maximum. And the Sixers like admitted their chances of keeping him healthy for an extended period of time are low, and that they knew that when they were signing him to that like supermax contract. So I was going to ask like how you think the team should go about handling that sort of situation. Like you said that it's not a tank situation right now because the team added Paul George in free agency. So it's like, I'm curious what the PG experience has been like, because, you know, I dealt with him in Oklahoma City for a long time. I was so happy when they made that trade that really turned around their franchise. The Sixers are definitely not in a position where they would be able to make any sort of trade like that. It's not 2019 anymore. So the fact that they are 8-16 now, I'm wondering, do you think that this season can be salvaged, or is there like any sort of realm in which you're going to start thinking about hunting for like Cooper Flagg, Dylan Harper?
Oh my God, if we got Cooper Flagg, that'd be so good, because that would be like a real kick in the teeth to New England.
I always love kicking New England in the teeth. I'm good
Why
with that.
You hate New England? Right, what did they do to you?
It sucks.
I just mean like it would like, okay, so the Celtics are really, really good right now. So New England sports fans are in a very comfortable position. If you give them a little bit of a bittersweet, okay, but Cooper Flagg, because this is the thing, it's not just that he's from Maine, it's also like he's white, so they would like love him, and so just kind of giving them a little bit of a...
He's a perfect superstar for them. They're missing out on him.
Yeah, he's their Superman.
Yeah, it's true. It's a shame he didn't go to BYU.
Yeah. I'm still obsessed with the Jewish quarterback at BYU. I think about him kind of every day. I'll just be on and about, and I'll just think about him, and then I'll sort of sit with that for a second.
Well, there's a good Sam Morril bit where he talks about how the NBA hasn't belong to the Jews since the 50s. He's like, they all looked like me back then. Like, you know, I think, I don't know, I'm half Italian and half Jewish, so I think that's when I peaked in sports, and now
we're getting by elite a little bit. Power forward in 1957, Brody.
Exactly.
Well, topically, the new Superman is Jewish.
Is he really?
He's Jewish,
I didn't know that. Juperman.
Yeah, nice.
Thank you.
And he's an Eagles fan, so
I don't know who that is. Here's another thing that I just sort of thought about when you mentioned Jared McCain. I feel like after last year's NFL draft, there was like so much talk about how will America react to like Caleb Williams. There were a lot of people saying that he was like going to be the first Gen Z American sports superstar because he would paint his nails and shit, and he like cried in the stands after a game, and I guess people thought that that was like scandalous or whatever. I haven't really heard like anything from that out of the Bears in like a year since that happened. Like, it seems like Caleb Williams doesn't have as much of a personality as we expected, or they're like actively sort of suppressing that. But I feel like Jared McCain is sort of taking up the mantle, or at least was before the injury, as being America's like Zoomer star athlete, or at least like the first one to be like doing TikToks, painting his nails, and not really caring what the like macho fan bases say about him. So
I just found, not to completely derail the conversation,
no, it's fine.
I just found a screenshot that is David Corenswet, who is the guy playing Superman, the new Superman. This is a shot from the set of the new Superman, and I don't know why, but they gave Clark Kent an E-boy fuckboy haircut.
Yeah, he's got the curl. He has that in the trailer. I watched the trailer because a bunch of people were doing discourse about the trailer on my Twitter timeline, so I just had to tap in. That is the hair he has.
Why? Wow. For what reason?
We went from Zoomer superstars to Zoomer Superman in a record time right there.
Exactly. He kind of looks like an American Cillian Murphy in this second picture. He's got like the hair swoopy thing going on. And then for some reason, they decided to stick what looks like a wig of the worst TikTok teenager. Like, you know, to make him Superman. I don't get it.
Unbelievable.
That, no offense, the top picture, that is a guy who corners you at the party and is talking about his how he's seeing IMAX Interstellar 6 times this week. Who that is.
Nolan, are you that might hit a little too close to home for you. Sorry.
I only saw it once. It's okay. No offense taken. Hell of an experience, say, Molly, though. I enjoyed
that. Don't get him started on Christopher Nolan. Nolan on Nolan would be...
No, you can get me started. I feel like I'm pretty, like, normal about him. I'm not, you know, just because he's my, like, namesake. A few of my friends did team up to go see the re-release in IMAX. So I got to see those guys for the first time in a while, and that was a lot of fun. But I think those are the only two Christopher Nolan movies where I'm kind of like, yeah, that's the real deal. I'm not a Dark Knight stan. That's a fun movie. There's a lot of dumb shit in it, though. I will acknowledge that. He's a fun
Fun reunion
director,
with your friends aside. You just proved Molly's point.
Fair enough. He's kind of the Spielberg of our generation, and I don't particularly like Spielberg, so maybe he's my Spielberg. Working a lot of things out in real time.
Well, I think the one thing about him that I've discovered this week is that he has bad taste, because he said the best movie of the year was Gladiator 2. Which
I haven't seen it yet, but I feel like it's not.
Boy. I also have not seen Gladiator. Have you seen Gladiator 2, Molly?
Yeah, I've seen, I'm going to say, I've seen fucking everything. I've seen Gladiator 2. I've seen Wicked twice. I've seen Queer twice. Very different experiences. I've seen the new Timothée Chalamet, Bob Dylan movie. Okay, so that's my Wicked. That's the one where I was sitting along. I loved it. And the problem is I keep bumping into people and they keep saying, like, is it perfect? Is it amazing? And I'm like, I loved it. I cannot prove objectively how good it is. But I was so into it. I had the best time ever. So I really like that.
I want to see what the reviews are. Because it's, what is it called again?
A complete unknown.
I brought this up a few times on the podcast. I had my doubts where Chalamet was going to be playing Bob Dylan. The other day, girlfriend Bryce and I went up to New Paltz, small little town in the Hudson Valley. It's beautiful. It's like close to Woodstock. It's on the west side of the river. There was a guy who was dressed literally in the exact, like, ruffian British orphan from the 40s thing. Like, this exact outfit that I just put into the chat. And I'll also throw this into the thumbnail so that people can see. This dude was literally wearing this, like, rough scarf, the same hat, and, like, a really, like, rough spun coat. And it was just, like, a regular guy. But I think we've gone too far with, like, Timothée Chalamet now getting to play Bob Dylan. And we can't make this style like a thing where it comes back and everyone wants to be like a little scamp, like running around like a little folksy scamp.
We cannot have Artful Dodger ass little boys running around.
It's not good.
Like
no.
This. Also,
it's like Nouveau but, Oliver Twist.
But this is the thing that I think, so people were like, does Chalamet like nail it? And for my money, he does. Because one of the things that he does is he is giving worst boyfriend you've ever had. Like
oh,
there
that's
is,
totally Bob Dylan.
There is a
and him.
Where Elle Fanning goes to Italy to do her study abroad and he fucks someone else in her apartment. And then she comes back and she sees that coffee's been made. She's like, oh my, did you teach yourself how to use the coffee maker, Bob? And I like scream laugh. Like I fully lost it. Like he is, you know that meme about the broke boyfriend and the bodega, like stand, like giving the girlfriend the hug because she's paying for everything?
Yeah.
That is fire vibe in the movie because he has no money and he keeps like talking down to people. There are multiple scenes where like an insanely hot woman is like lying in bed. She's like, Bob, get back into bed. And he's like, I can't. I'm writing Blowing in the Wind.
That's the most James Mangold thing I've ever heard in my life.
I think Timothy Chalamet has been waiting his whole life for that role, because I do think that's kind of what he actually is like. I wouldn't be too surprised. Like, not that he's writing Blow in the Wind, that he's preparing for, you know, his next big feature. That's really funny.
His longtime girlfriend is a billionaire. I mean, yeah. Checks out.
How NYU coded.
I'll tell you what. If this movie gives every crazy-ass white boy the confidence to buy an acoustic guitar again, the problem of Americans knowing Oasis is going to go away immediately. I think we can kill two birds with one stone with this Bob Dylan movie.
Maybe if this is what the generation needs to get them into guitars and Bob Dylan, I'm okay with it. Just don't dress like a ruffian from 1940.
Molly, my last question about the Sixers. Do you have any thoughts about the fact that if you guys don't pick in the top six, your pick goes to the Oklahoma City Thunder?
Okay, so on personal grounds, love that fear.
Thank you.
On political grounds, I will fucking lose it.
I feel like you guys might need that one more than we do.
The West is sort of good, and like the East is literally just the Celtics. It's really demoralizing.
We're back in 2015. It's so weird. It's like the Thunder, the Rockets, the Mavericks. I mean, Draymond Green had a minus 42 last night, so I guess we're not fully back there, but that was unbelievable to watch. We'll switch topics to something a little bit more upbeat than the 2024-25 Philadelphia 76ers. But the thing that I kind of wanted to mention because of what we were talking about, Brody, the last time that we did the pod, is we were recording that one live as the NBA Cup final was happening between the Thunder and the Bucks, and I was quietly seething the entire time watching them shoot 1-for-17 from three in the first half, and then finish the game 5-for-32 from beyond the arc with a 97-81 loss. That is the worst, I think, that the Thunder have looked in a while. I've not seen them look overmatched since the Dallas series, when it was like painfully obvious that they needed a center. Like, I went into last year's playoffs kind of being like, even though they're the number one seed, I don't think this is going to be the year, because I don't know what they're going to do about Jokic. I don't know what they're going to do about Giannis, if they even get to him, you know what I mean? It's like they need that paint presence, and then the Isaiah Hartenstein signing has been so fantastic. He played a really good game last night. It just didn't matter because Giannis was wreaking havoc all night, playing at the very top of his game. He had a triple-double with 26 points, 19 rebounds, 10 assists. Damian Lillard had 23 points on 5-for-10 shooting from three. Darvin Ham seems to be like the NBA Cup god. He has won both of the NBA Cups now, as has Taurean Prince. Really just an unfathomably bad shooting night from the Thunder, which makes me think that that is more of a fluke than like an exposition on the part of the Bucks. Like, I don't think that that is what a typical OKC game is going to look like come playoff time. I don't think they're going to be shooting 17% from three moving forward, and I don't want to jump to conclusions over one bad game. They've been handling good teams all year. I believe they've even beaten every team that they've lost to thus far in the regular season, so I'm still very, very confident in both the short and the long-term outlook of the Thunder season. I will say, though, this is the first time all year that I've definitely felt like they need another creator. They have a lot of guys with similar skill sets, like especially those guards off the bench. Cason Wallace got the start last night, but he's usually a bench guy. Alex Caruso, AJ Mitchell, all have not been great from three this year. They've been pretty streaky shooting, especially Caruso, I think, is below 30% from three on the year. And then Isaiah Joe just didn't show up in the game on Tuesday, and he can't play any defense to begin with. So if he's not hitting his shots and the other guys also aren't hitting their shots, like, it could potentially get very ugly. So, and they're missing Chet. I know they're missing Chet. They have like the best defense of all time without their best defensive player. I can't overstate how insane that is. But they just have so many assets right now that I think it could make sense to consolidate somewhere. Maybe they could make a trade for like Cameron Johnson from the Nets, send Isaiah Joe, maybe Ujman Jang and a couple picks or something like that. I think that probably gets it done. They have more draft capital than any other team, more assets. So if they need to see a move made, we will see it made. I trust Presti to make the right move. I still feel pretty good despite what was truly an ugly watch on Tuesday night. the fact
were you more upset because the game was bad or because they lost this NBA Cup? Because I'm kind of curious, again, like we talked about this a little bit last week. I don't think that it matters. I would have been upset if the Knicks made it and lost a little, I guess. But like, I don't think it would have really had an effect. Like, I don't know. How did it feel to lose it?
The fact that they were playing against a star like Giannis, a guy who can expose what has been a flaw in the team for a long time, and the fact that they were on that stage and they shot 1-for-17 in the first half sort of leads me to ask more questions about, like, is experience going to be a problem for this team come like April or May? I care about that a lot more than I do about losing the in-season tournament. I did think it was pretty cool, you know, like I was very excited when they beat Houston in the semifinals and that other game. So I was like, hey, that's awesome, going to the NBA Cup. But then actually, like, losing it and watching the Bucks celebrate, like, I don't really care that much. I would be a lot more upset if that was the NBA Finals, and this will never be the NBA Finals. I think they have to see it as a bit of a, like, building block, you know? It was a bit of a wake-up call in terms of maybe we go out and get Cameron Johnson, but I don't think we saw flaws in the team's game that, like, makes me think that they can't go out and win a championship, because they absolutely still can. I think that's going to do it for basketball talk this week on Mudville. We're going to transition now to our next topic of the week. Molly, last year when you came on to the podcast, you told us about all of the films that you were so lucky to see at the London Film Festival. Why don't we keep that tradition alive today and have you go through some of your favorites from this year's lineup and some of the films that you're most excited to talk about?
I saw a bunch, and I weirdly had a really high hit rate. I think also I have a thing where I rate a truly staggering number of movies 5 stars, but when I was looking back at my LFF, it's a lot of really good movies. So the first film I saw was the opening night of the festival was Goodwin, which was directed by India Donaldson and was, I think, filmed in upstate New York. So kind of a you guys kind of movie.
I will need to check that out.
If it's not upstate New York, I don't have to be right about these things. I'm not American. I don't know where America is.
Hey, we didn't have to be right about
it's
Robbie
usually
Williams.
No matter where you are, it's West.
You can get our foliage wrong for all I care. The only movie that I've seen that was anywhere close to, like, filmed where I actually live was Place Beyond the Pines. Like, that was the only time I saw a movie, and I was like, oh, I recognize these trees and these roads. And it's, like, not exactly where I'm from, but it's, like, definitely the most I've had that experience. But, sorry, continue.
You watch that movie and you're like, oh my God, he's just like me, for real. It's actually a really good foliage movie. It's apart from Perfect Days, like those are the two movies to me that this year were the best looking up through light refracting through trees moments. I went in knowing basically nothing about it, and I recommend that other people do the same. It's really good performances, nice, tight movie, beautiful, beautiful, like, hiking stuff, and very interesting things go down. I loved it. And I had the great fortune of sitting through the credits and then seeing a friend's name in the producing credits. And I texted her, I was literally like, I think I just saw a movie that you produced, which was a real cool moment. So I recommend that. It was very, very small budget. I'm not sure if it's been made public how small the budget is, but it's one of those genuine triumphs of, like, independent cinema.
I got to add that one to my list. That checks off all of my boxes, honestly.
Wait, real quick, what was the title of the one you said was filmed upstate? I'm trying to find it.
Good One.
It's called Good One. I want to say the Catskills, but I don't know where the Catskills are.
They're north of the city, way up. They're very close to me.
The second movie I saw at the festival was Anora, which, heard of it.
Oh, yeah. Seen that one.
Haven't seen it yet, but absolutely heard of it. We did his name, Sean Baker?
Sean Baker, yeah.
His name. We did one of his films 2 weeks ago.
Actually. Yeah, Red Rocket.
This one is, I'm surprised the amount of people that I've been talking to, like, have been saying they want to go see Anora. I'm like, oh, I know that guy. You know,
hey, that's my buddy.
I do need to see it. But we liked Red Rocket. How was Anora?
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was so wonderful. And the main thing when I was leaving it, I had the same feeling I had when I was leaving Challengers, where I thought, I cannot wait to rewatch that. Like, it's just, there's obviously a lot of comedy involved, I think is kind of a hallmark of everything he's doing. But it's really good. Some really amazing just, like, chemistry and character acting, and, like, the supporting parts are really good. I was watching, I was thinking the same thing when I was seeing A Complete Unknown. There are so many random, really good sort of character acting moments, because there's all these other people playing other characters in A Complete Unknown. So every time someone turns up, you're like, oh my goodness, this person's like killing it out of nowhere, playing the supporting role. And I think Anora is like that, where, okay, there's an incredibly strong central performance, but the supporting actors and particularly the comedy, I think, really, really worked for me. What the thing that's really funny is that I've told multiple friends to see it in the months since I saw it. So a bunch of my friends dragged their boyfriends, and all my friends liked it and all their boyfriends didn't.
What?
Which is so confusing to me. But it genuinely broke down on gender lines for reasons I cannot understand, where all my friends liked it and all their boyfriends were just totally out on it and just like thought it was dumb.
Is this the reverse Uncut Gems? Because I was going to say they're very similar movies, but after hearing that, I don't know. I feel like everybody's boyfriend loved Uncut Gems. That's putting a lot together in real time on the episode this week. I mean, I loved Anora as well. I thought that was like one of the most entertaining films that I'd seen all year. I was sort of expecting it to be a like guys getting tortured in seedy basements vibe by like the end of the movie, and instead it was more of a Three Stooges slapstick routine type deal, which personally pleasantly surprised me a lot. I mean, I was much, much happier to see a bunch of goofballs, you know, than I would have been to see like Russian oligarchs destroying any last trace of humanity in their realm. I'm happy that that wasn't the type of movie that Anora was. What did you think about like the arc of their relationship between Annie and Vanya? Because it sort of confused me a little bit towards the end when, spoilers for Anora, by the way, if you would like to see the movie and you haven't seen it yet, skip ahead like 2 minutes. Give you 1 minute to do that. Okay. That's your time. So towards the end, when she's saying like, you committed all of this to me and you said all of these things to me, and now you're like telling me that we don't matter. Like, what the hell is this? And he's like, thank you for making my last trip to America so great. And she's so like emotionally devastated. I was a little bit conflicted on how that worked for me dramatically, because I felt like we knew from the start that he was a dipshit, and that seemed to me like an inevitability. That's why I'm even kind of okay saying it on the pod, is it's like that was going to happen from the get-go. I feel like even it's even like marketed in the trailer what a like vapid dipshit that kid is. I felt like I had to suspend belief a little bit to feel like that character, who we see is so street smart and like savvy and like aware of her surroundings and the people in her life, it sort of makes me feel like she would have been aware of that as well and wouldn't have allowed herself to get so emotionally invested in this kid. But at the same time, it's like I can see how the like material reality of all of these things happening to her for the first time and like this great life that she's never seen before being presented to her, that she could sort of fall for that. And she ultimately fell head over heels into that reality and then had such a harsh wake up call. But for me, it just felt like that was always coming and was so inevitable that I just didn't know that I could personally feel that with the character. But I'm curious about your experience in that moment.
So my thinking is, because she is so smart, because she has such an awareness of herself, I think that she thought that, yeah, he's, you know, silly and clearly hasn't had all his ducks in a row in terms of getting all this stuff signed off by his parents. But I think she thought that she was smart enough, and also kind of that she earned it enough that it was all going to work out. To me, that in that moment, that's her realizing that everything she's been through is kind of for nothing. She doesn't get the fairy tale ending, which I guess is a small amount of naivete, but I think that sometimes speaks to the fact that sometimes people are so smart that they end up in dumb situations. I think if I'm in this bad situation, I'm just going to kind of smart my way out of it. And obviously that doesn't always happen the way you want it to.
Yeah, glad that you enjoyed that movie. I certainly did as well. I guess that's all that I have to say on that now. What's the next one?
The next film I saw was Night Bitch, which I remembered going into it. I was like, this is going to be a mess. Like, this is going to be bad. And it's way more successful than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be these weird tonal shifts between the sort of straightforward narrative of Amy Adams is dealing with motherhood and her marriage and the fact that she's not working anymore and navigating this. And there's these weird, wacky, comedic moments where she's turning into a dog. But the whole thing is just her turning into a dog. So there's not any tonal shifts. It sort of establishes this weird, heightened, comedic, very dramatic tone at the start and then just kind of holds through to that. I didn't love it. I don't think I'd ever watch it again. But it really works. And I left it and I was like, shout out, because it feels like a book when you're watching, because it's based on a book And the way that it's written feels very sort of writerly, but it really works. And Scoot McNairy plays her husband. And any movie that Scoot McNairy is in is going to be a movie where I'm at least kind of in the tank for it. So, I mean, that's like not a run, don't walk situation, but it was my, I guess, my pleasant surprise. And that's kind of funny because I then saw the movie that I thought sucked, which is We Live in Time, which is by a director who I really like, who made Brooklyn. And I encourage everyone to go and see this movie and tell me that it's not so badly balanced between its main two characters. Florence Pugh in it is this wunderkind cook, and she has this big family and all these friends. And then genuinely, Andrew Garfield is like a depressed, divorced man who lives with his dad, who has nothing. His only job is to kind of be her boyfriend and then later her husband. And the few times in the film where his character tries to assert himself, Florence then screaming at him. So for example, he says, oh, you know, I think I'm falling in love with you and I want to make sure we're aligned on our views on children. And she literally says, like, she literally tells him to fuck himself. And it's really crazy because coming into this movie, everyone was talking about how Florence is the beating heart of the movie. And she is given a character that is so unlikable that it's kind of scary. The whole structure of the film is all these moments in time. So it's, you know, a non-linear narrative. And the result of that is there is no emotional build to any catharsis or to any outcome. You know, you find out that she has cancer and then it cuts to them meeting rather than you sort of have the normal ebb and flow of a relationship leading to this inflection point of her diagnosis and then them going forward with that. It does not take a lot for a movie to make me cry. And when I tell you I didn't feel a thing for them in an objectively very tragic story, like, that is a very bad sign. I start crying the second that Brooklyn starts and I hear like the opening score. I'm already crying. The director then making this, which made me feel nothing. And it's a cancer movie and they have a very cute kid. I was just like, this is insane.
How did this not work?
I need people to go and see it because I need people to talk about how completely misjudged it was.
I have not seen it yet, but now I'm excited to see it and see if I feel the same way, because that sounds to me like a huge problem in terms of how it's like paced.
So the trailer for that came on before Nolan, I think it was Conclave, and we were sitting there and my girlfriend enjoys a good sappy romance. And so she was like, we need to see that. And I was like, absolutely not. Like, I'm not going to watch a depressing cancer movie. I just can't do that. You know, and it has nothing to do with sappy romance. I like sappy romance. We've been trying to watch Love Actually recently. I don't like cancer and I'm not big on death movies. So I was like, you know what? Just the movie In Time is great. That one really makes me cry. Girlfriend always wants to watch that one. And I keep on saying, I don't really think that's like a relax and throw on In Time type movie. And she was like, I really want to see We Live in Time. And I was like, I don't think that I'll enjoy that very much. So now the next time she brings it up, I'm going to absolutely hammer her with the fact that it's terrible. And it actually won't make you feel anything. So then, you know, I'll win that one. There we go.
Did you end up getting to watch Love Actually? Because I saw that again recently. And I've gone through a bit of a roller coaster with that, where I used to think that that movie sucked. And then it's there was so a time when I like really liked it. And now I think that I still really like it, despite the fact that it sucks.
It's a great movie in that you just kind of get to enjoy these characters. Half of them are awful people. Half of them are just like really, you just can't root for them. I don't know. It's just enjoyable. It's just flat out enjoyable in that it's not like a fantastic movie, but you just get to enjoy.
Fair enough.
But this one, you know, I like Andrew Garfield too. And Florence Pugh was always in stuff that is designed to make you sad.
What's next, Molly?
The next one was Queer, which I've now seen twice.
And I haven't seen once yet. And I'm so excited for this one, but I'm excited to hear your thoughts.
I've seen it written insanely long Letterboxd reviews, so that's a kind of a sign of how I'm feeling a lot of things. It's a kind of movie where both times going into it, I was thinking to myself, okay, right, this is like 3 hours, I need to really lock in, and it's only about 2 hours 15, so it kind of races through stuff. Daniel Craig is doing really interesting things in his late career. In terms of Challenges and Queer, I probably would rewatch Challenges more because it's so fun. But Queer is so beautiful, particularly the first third where they're in Mexico. They sort of recreated this vision of Mexico in Italy. And it looks, there are multiple things that look like a Hopper painting. There's so much happening in the background of shots. There's so much like gorgeous like neon lighting. Daniel Craig is doing a really interesting performance where he's kind of sweet, empathetic, and obviously dealing with serious substance abuse issues. And it's a really interesting performance. And then Drew Starkey, who is the other main character, really sort of small, sort of enigmatic performance. You don't ever really know what the situation is here. You never know how much this relationship is a real, both of them in the tank for each other, actual feelings thing versus something more transactional or something more sort of situational, because they both happen to be where they are. And obviously they're somewhat minority population, but it's a thing where there's so much stuff where there's issues around money and concept of living in exile, plus the question about, you know, queer identity, plus all this, all the drug and alcohol abuse and sort of the hallucinatory elements of the third act, where I think the whole point of it is you don't really know what's going on. The whole point of it is these are people who are going to struggle to define things. And it's just one of those movies where I walked out and I was like, I have so many thoughts about the concept of desire. Like, it's one of those movies where you just like want to go and just like have a bunch of drinks and be like, and this thing was really crazy. And this is, there's literally a moment where, spoiler alert, they throw up their hearts. And it's like, I've been there. I've done that. So yeah, I loved it. The cinematography in it is so good. Everyone has been talking about how bad the cinematography is in Wicked. The cinematography in Queer is so gorgeous. It looks so good. And there's a Come As You Are needle drop that genuinely both times I've been in the movie theater, I've been like, yes, this is the greatest moment of my life. So I like Queer, but also I've had some friends who saw it and didn't like it. And I've been so much like, this is such a subjective movie, but I'm very excited for you to see it. I think it rules.
A good needle drop can honestly like make an entire movie. I completely agree. Nothing turns a 4-star movie into a 5-star movie faster than a song that I personally like. I'm really looking forward to seeing that. I think I'm going to see it this week, so I will definitely let you know what I think of it.
Daniel Craig's filmography is so strange. He's such a good actor, and I feel like he doesn't get a lot of shots at being a good actor.
He used his James Bond clout to turn his career into something even way more interesting than that.
Way more interesting.
Shout out to him.
Exactly.
Yeah. Speaking of Luca Guadagnino's 2024 actors being James Bond, which is an incredibly specific thing to be speaking of, apparently Josh O'Connor is now rumored to be the next James Bond. And I kind of hope that doesn't happen, because I'd like to see him in more interesting work. Like, he's been in La Chimera this year and Challengers, which two of the most interesting roles I've seen. And I think he's having one of the best years of any actors in the world. So it would kind of suck to see him wrapped up for the next like 10 years playing James Bond. We'll see what happens. You know, maybe if that does happen, he'll make the best of it and have a Daniel Craig-esque career path. That is going to do it for Molly's London Film Festival lineup for this year. Thank you so much for sharing all that wonderful information with us. I personally cannot wait to see Good One, can't wait to see Queer, obviously loved Anora, and I am much more interested now in seeing Night Bitch than I definitely was before, so a lot of good movies being discussed. Why don't we move now into this week's double feature, which we teased a little bit earlier. We are talking about Connor O'Malley's Rap World and Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. Let's start with Rap World, which came out earlier this year, had a very brief run at a couple different festivals. There was an event that I personally really wanted to go to where they were playing this alongside Matt Farley's Local Legends Bloodbath. Two things that I just would have loved to be there. Unfortunately, it was in Canada, and I am not a Canadian. Connor O'Malley kind of just randomly uploaded it onto his YouTube channel one day, which I thought was pretty cool. This is going to be a fascinating plot point in Connor O'Malley's journey from YouTuber and like alt comedian into a filmmaker. The first time actually that I personally was made aware of something that Connor O'Malley had done, I believe it was his Truth Hunters video that he put on YouTube, which was essentially just a parody of InfoWars and Alex Jones, where he was playing this character, I think was named Mark Stevers or Mark Cheevers or something like that, who was incredibly excited about Donald Trump winning the presidency. And then anytime someone from his life would come into the shot, he would like confront them and start yelling at them and add like a chyron on the bottom of the screen. Like his brother walks in and he puts Capital One credit card holder on screen. That was sort of my first introduction to Conor O'Malley in that like 21-minute video. And I think that this proved to me that not only can he build on what I thought was so promising about that, but he can like craft a story for, this is just under an hour, but like it didn't even feel close to running out of steam. So it's like he can really hold your attention for a while without losing any momentum and keeping his comedy like top tier. Because I mean, I think Conor O'Malley is one of the funniest people working today, but this was just so unlike anything I had seen him do. The fact that it's just free on YouTube, just under an hour, I think is a real gift to anybody who wants to go and check this out. Especially, you know, if you grew up like around one of these places at any point in the 21st century, you're going to be able to resonate pretty strongly with a lot of stuff that's in this. Brody, I will kick it to you because I know that you just watched it for the first time last night. Had you seen any of Conor O'Malley's other stuff in the past? Was this your introduction to him? And if so, what did you think?
I have only known him from I Think You Should Leave, which he's fantastic and I Think You Should Leave. So I was very pleasantly surprised to realize that he's a great writer. Not surprised. I had no idea what to expect when you said Rap World, and I looked it up and I was like prepared to, you know, go find it somewhere. And then I just Googled it and it was like YouTube, 55 minutes. And I was like, wait a minute, what is this? Once I started watching it, I realized what was going on. And it did take me an embarrassingly long time to realize that this was not actual footage from when he was young and he just like found it, cut it together and threw it out there. But once I did realize that, I was like, wait, this is the best thing that I've ever seen. And one of the comments that I think put it so, so, so perfectly is that it's Superbad meets Blair Witch, which is hilarious. I think that's a very apt way to put it. This is like 2009, I was in fifth grade. So this is like, it's a little, you know, before exactly like my time, but it does reek of like what I knew about what was going on with the kids who were just a little older than me at the time. So it's kind of cool to like take you back to that window of just like watching them from afar and just kind of like seeing teenagers when you're a little kid. And like, this is exactly what you picture is going on, you know? And it's really like, it also just, one of them is wearing like an Avenged Sevenfold t-shirt. And it's like, you know, it's really transportative, immersive, I guess. It really, it pulls you into that time really well. And the camera, you know, being like this piece of crap old digital thing, like, you know, it's all very, the aesthetic is perfect. Like, they nailed the vibe of 2009 really well. And then the characters are so funny. Each one is just like, I think I texted you while I was watching it that the introduction of Matt's sister is one of the best comedic moves in the history of filmmaking.
Yep.
Like just having her show up and be like, it's like working at Walgreens isn't even a real job. She goes, what? You don't even work. You owe me money. Just that snap cut. Like, it's just so good. All of it is so good. It really does nail that like small town messing around with your friends type thing. And it, you know, it's very cozy and really funny and just, you know, it's a perfect 50-minute watch. I really enjoyed it.
That is absolutely one of the main like appeals of this to me. I mean, Brody, the fact that you didn't know that this was not old footage from when Conor O'Malley was younger in 2009, yeah, making this rap video with his friends. I mean, that goes to show, I think, how committed they are to this aesthetic and how well the execution was. That, I mean, you can see this and you're just like immediately back drinking a Monster Energy and like yelling at your mom who wouldn't let you go to Walmart.
And trying to Heely.
Yeah. Molly, I'll kick it to you. You brought this one to the podcast. You've seen it now a couple of times. What is so impressive to you about Rap World?
My original take on it was, this is Twin Peaks Return for guys who used to play Call of Duty on a hot couch. But I kind of think it's actually Inland Empire now that I think about it in terms of how it's actually presented. But it's just, there were just certain things where I kept pausing to like screenshot. And this is one of the things that people watching things on Netflix are losing is like the ability to screenshot things and like sharing. The guy with the chyron that says recently uncle died underneath, every single time they cut to a different location with a like quick break to grocery store for snacks for being high, and when they say tensions ran high, that didn't know Jason was going to be there, and tensions have spelled wrong, like all the transitions, like it's just this thing where, you know, a lot of times production design things, people think about that in terms of being like a beautiful Wes Anderson thing, which to be fair, Wes Anderson actually incredibly underrated in terms of production design by the Academy. But this is also just like the craziest production design because it was every single guy. And this is the thing, is like the guy you meet who is your friend's older brother who is a loser. And you are expecting to think he's cool because he's older, but he is just reeks of being a loser. And I literally ever since have been quoting the look into 9/11 and it's like, oh, you think the firefighters did it? I have been saying that ever since I saw it. And I've seen it multiple times. I think about that constantly. And the line that I think I've seen this in a bunch of people's reviews, but the line, which is some of the best nights of my life were spent in parking lots. It is that thing of like being a teenager and you live in such a piece of shit town.
Perfect tagline.
Your whole life, it is like, it is the famous like Trapper Trap House concept of the hot couch with a DVD menu playing. And like there's like a brown towel that you have to use at some point. And so it's like other people's shitty basements where they're like huffing petrol and smoking and parking lots. And like someone has a job, but they're constantly getting fired from it. Or like, yeah, someone's sister, someone's girlfriend has
the only one with money.
Yeah. And you're just like almost getting them fired constantly. Like it's just, I think I grew up partially in the suburbs in Australia and partially in the city in London, like that suburban just burnout lifestyle. Like that, it doesn't matter who, like, you know, a guy who is like these guys, or they were kind of like the living legends of your high school, but they were just such losers. And I love any movie about a guy who kind of sucks. Like that is a really,
it's the best. That's why we like Red Rock.
Exactly. I was just going to say, Brody, we talked about one the other week.
Also, the cousin Serge Lopecia hanging out in his basement, then his mom comes down and screams at him that you don't do that to your grandmother. When he left her with nothing but a book of crosswords.
This movie like understands cousins so well, especially if like your cousin is a piece of shit. It's just like you see that in Serge Lopecia like instantly. And Molly, you're talking about how so many quotes in this movie have just like immediately entered your lexicon. For me, the line is, she doesn't get applesauce, she gets food.
She gets food.
I don't want to be the guy who's just like repeating other people's jokes, but when they're this funny, I mean, you kind of just have to like give credit to the fact that somebody conceived of this and wrote it down and was able to execute it in the manner that I'm going to think about it every day for the rest of my life. Like that whole scene is just so real. Like when everybody's shitting on Jason for like going to the other high school in the town, because it's like there's clearly so much lore between the like high school rivalries. Like that brought me back to my home town as well, where it's like this is like such a big deal,
like Halloween masks.
And he's
that line, and I'm writing a script called Violence Land again, like I keep thinking about, but it's just like it's also really funny because apparently the few screenings they've done of it, at one point Connor Miller was like, okay, put up your hand if you're a woman who's at the screening who was not brought here by your boyfriend. And it was like two women. Like this is such a like babe,
it's a dude's rock movie. Yeah. It's only an hour. Only an hour. You're going to love it.
I promise to do hand stuff afterwards. Like, I got you. You're
going to love it.
So this one is documenting the making of a rap album that these three guys are producing over one night in the town of Tobyhanna, Pennsylvania in 2009. Matt Lohan is the ringleader of the operation. This is Connor O'Malley's character. He's sort of the head rapper in their crew. He is a movie theater employee. It starts, we show up in the back of his movie theater and the manager is like curious what these guys are doing, and they're like, oh, we're making a movie about them making an album. And then Connor O'Malley's like, that guy fucking sucks. Casey is the one who has the camera. Brody, that's the one with the Avenged Sevenfold shirt and the like dirt stash. I felt like I went to high school with like 30 of him. This was an incredible character. Crucially, Casey's house is open for the weekend because his mom is in Puerto Rico getting surgery to have her ears separated from her head. And Jason is not Matt's favorite. He is part of the crew because he has the production equipment and he is the one who is able to make the beats, which we see is just a file on Audacity. So this is the trio that is creating the best rap album in Toby Hanna history on this night in 2009. It starts with a like montage of some of the different moments across the night, and then it is set to Viva La Vida by Coldplay. Good. We're talking about like the perfect usage choice of music just being able to like evoke a time period like perfectly. Like when I see these guys driving around in their SUV, first listening to Viva La Vida, yep. Later on when it does the hard cut to them listening to John Mayer, it's just so perfect.
Right after
it's so 2009.
Fight, when he gets yelled at for trying to propose, and it smash cuts to them raining in the, or it's raining and they're in the car driving home to Free Fallin' by John Mayer, his cover. I mean, I watched this partially in a place where I should have not been making much noise, and I was very much having a hard time stifling laughs, like trying not to completely die.
So they bring back McDonald's from the drive-thru. They eat it together. Jason eats a Tootsie Pop and documents himself doing it as they're driving back with the food. As they're eating the McDonald's, Matt confronts Jason and tells him that he doesn't want him involved with the project at all and is afraid that he's going to entirely ruin it. Jason infers that Casey is actually the leader of the group and Casey is the one who invited him, so he's staying. Right after that, Jason shows them like one shitty beat that he made, and Matt loses his mind over how good it is and apologizes. They start playing with Casey's parents' gun, taking a bunch of pictures of the three of them, like holding it up at each other, like pretending to be going in and making a big drug bust. Matt pretends to like light up a joint in the bathroom, and Casey screams at him. It just gives such a good sense of like what it's like to hang out with these guys who talk so much and like act so big, but are still terrified of getting yelled at by their parents. This is where we meet Serge Lopecia. We go to hang out with Casey's cousin and Paula, who yells at him for not feeding his grandmother. The four of them are playing Wii Sports, which what's more nostalgic than Wii Sports? And like I mentioned earlier, they're roasting Jason for going to the other high school. And he's like, it's actually one of the top schools for both English and history. So, and I just found that so funny. One thing I just love about this movie is spaces, the settings, the parking lots, the Sports Authority, nighttime grocery stores, you know, going on a run that feels like is so important and so exciting at the time. And then you look back on it, it's like, oh, I was just driving to the store kind of at night. And this evokes so well that feeling of like, this is the only thing that matters in the world, and that's just kind of what I like so much about it. They go to play beer pong with their high school buddies. This is where we meet Kira English, who I think is one of the like realest characters in the movie. Like I feel like I've met that person so many times when I was younger. Just this girl who is so loud and obnoxious, and yet like all of these guys are like, I don't want to say in love with, but at least Jason is like proposing monogamy to her, even though she I think has a completely different boyfriend. And then I mean that turns into, you know, just such a like public disaster, and they get kicked out of the party, and then we get that cut to them listening to John Mayer in the car.
Riley Byro more on the other hand instead.
Matt's ex-girlfriend comes over angry because someone from the party like told her that he was out and hanging out with other women or something, and they fight, which Matt records for a custody hearing, which is some of the best stuff in the movie, just with Connor O'Malley and this actress who, forgive me, I don't know her name right now, just yelling at each other over this total nothing of an argument, honestly, where she's like, you never let me go to the studio. And he's like, I didn't have a studio. I have a studio now because Casey's mom is getting her ear separated from her head in Puerto Rico. Some of the funniest stuff I've seen in a movie this year. And Casey starts rapping complete gibberish over the end of their album. And then, crucially towards the very end, they go out to try to get the sound of the gun firing that they can put on the end of the album. And the bullet hits Matt in the leg. And you see him gushing blood from his leg. And they're like, Matt, are you okay? And he's like, yeah, we're okay. We made a fucking album, dude. And they like call the cops to tell them that Matt is okay. And then we get this hard cut as he's saying, like, we're having the time of our lives. We just cut straight to Matt's funeral. And we see him lying in the casket. We get all of these different characters fighting with each other at Matt's funeral. And it's just so, so funny.
His kid that you've all been hearing this whole fucking time.
He leaves behind one son who we've been hearing this entire fucking time. His sister and his ex-girlfriend fight at the funeral, and sort of the last note that we get is Casey giving Matt's eulogy, where he says he was surrounded by his best friends in the woods full of McDonald's. And how sad can it be if you go out doing what you love?
If you haven't noticed, I only watched this once again last night. This might be the most quotable movie I've ever seen, behind Superbad. It's up there. It's just every line is so memorable and so funny that you wouldn't download a car style intercuts are also perfect.
Rap World does a great job of capturing the feeling of spending a cold night in your northeastern hometown with two of your friends, driving around in one of their parents' Jeeps, eating McDoubles and trying to impress people who you'll never see again, or in many cases even think about. While these locations and scenes and feelings are not locked down to a particular moment in time, it does feel so evocative of 2009, which might just be because of the lack of advanced technology or consolidated social media. I felt like I saw people that I went to high school with in this movie. Not anybody that I keep in touch with, but the people who were always in ISS for blasting cigs in the bathroom and who would wear Cookie Monster pajamas to the abandoned mall. And there's just something beautiful in a movie that evokes forgotten memories, even if they aren't ones that are particularly of any value. I feel like I played Call of Duty Black Ops with every single character in this movie. This feels like a huge step in Connor O'Malley's career. A few years ago when I watched Freddy Got Fingered, my review was give Connor O'Malley $100 million. And after this, I think production companies that care about making comedies that are worth a damn and that are actually funny should really try to make that happen. It's no secret that he's like a special comedic talent, but this showed me that he's a damn good filmmaker as well. And this is one of my favorite movies of 2024, I think, for sure. The other film we're talking about this week is Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. Molly, you brought this one to the podcast, so I will kick it to you first. What is so special to you about this film, and why did you bring it onto the podcast with us this week?
One of the things that I think it gets really right, which I also think to some extent Rapwell does, is this idea of when you're a child or even a teenager, your whole life is kind of lived in communal arrangements. So you're either going somewhere with your family or going somewhere with your friends. You have very little alone time. You have very little autonomy to do things. And you experience the things that you experience kind of in a group. So the boys in The Virgin Suicide are obsessed with these girls. The boys are obsessed kind of as like a Greek chorus with these girls, and it's mainly them as a collective rather than individual aspects of them as people. And
I like that. Them as the muses.
It's also this idea of like, that is so suffocating. The idea that you kind of don't have your own sense of self, and the idea that this is kind of a movie that could only ever be made about teenage girls, because once you get to university, once you get into the workplace, it's more about you as an individual. Whereas when you're young and you're just sort of stuck in this group, it can be really difficult. So when you only really see them on their own when they're killing themselves, basically. So it's just this idea of the girls and the boys, also like the neighbors, all like they're all shit talking. I just think it's really interesting, and it's obviously such a beautiful film, and I think you see the kind of DNA in that. And I saw Janet Planet this year.
I was just thinking of that. Oh my God. Yeah. When we were talking about this, when you're young, like you exist in this particular community and like it's just your whole world and it just feels like it's the most important thing. And that made me think of Janet Planet. So it's just so interesting that you just brought that up, but continue.
Yeah. It's also just, she's at camp and she's like, if you don't come pick me up, I'm going to kill myself. And that girl in it is so wise on her years. Like she is like somehow is like 40 years old. Like she's so wise. I think about the Virgin Suicide. I also think about that in terms of, I saw The Iron Claw last year, and that's, you know, the idea of Zac Efron saying, I used to be a brother. And the idea that, like, when you, it's not just like I used to have an identity that related to how I related to other people, and it's gone forever. I think if you have time after your, like, 55 minutes of rap world, you should fire up Virgin Suicide and just have thoughts about gender and stuff.
A good framing for it. I did watch them back to back, and it was weird because you come from this, I started with rap world, then watched the Virgin Suicide after. And Rap World, you're watching these very, very free-spirited, but they're in like this landscape that they completely can do whatever they want, roam wherever they want to go, they do whatever they want to do. Again, it's one night and they're all stuck in their parents' basements, but you do get that feeling. And even when they get in trouble with someone's parents, it's Paula Lopecia who shows up and yells at the other one, and it doesn't matter. And it's so interesting because in The Virgin Suicides, these parents are super restrictive, and it makes it interesting that you see like the threat of parental helicoptering. I don't even know what you call it, like overparenting. It's a good juxtaposition for how these two different kinds of kids are raised and what becomes of them. And also just like it's familiar too, because I think like Molly, I don't know how prevalent this is in Australia or in London, but everyone kind of knew that there were certain kids whose parents were like this, you know, or something, not exactly to this degree, but similar, where it's just like, oh, they're not allowed to do anything. Like they can't do anything, whether it was like religious reasons or just how they wanted to raise the kids or whatever. And you just kind of, you felt bad for them, but that you didn't really understand it. Like you don't, it's interesting. It kind of brought back similar kind of memories of like, oh man, yeah, that sucks.
One of the things that I sort of kept thinking about was like how these individual characters exist within the context of their groups, how the groups exist parallel to each other, sort of playing off of one another. What it's like, one can't get too close to the other without sort of the whole thing falling apart, especially with the boys thinking about the sisters. It's like they are not knowable to them. And like that is at the core of the boys' fascination with them, both during their lives, but especially after their deaths, you know, it's like, is how this town reacts to the people within it and how these life-changing and extreme events that you think would like forever alter the fabric of the town around it ultimately just ends up becoming background noise in a world that maybe can't be changed. I'd like to just sort of go into what this movie is about first, like the actual story itself, like we did with Rap World, to try to understand it a little bit better. This is the story of the deaths of the five Lisbon girls, sisters in Michigan, who all committed suicide years before the narration of the story is taking place. We find that out right from the very beginning, told from the point of view of four men who were teenagers when the girls died. Some of the narration from Jeffrey Eugenides, I think is how you pronounce that. I'm not quite sure. His novel is fantastic. The sisters are Lux Lisbon is Kirsten Dunst's character, sort of the one that we are emotionally keyed into the most. She is the one who rebels against her strict parents, takes up a fling with Josh Hartnett's character, Tripp Fontaine. There is Cecilia Lisbon, who is the first one who commits suicide at the start of the movie. And we have AJ Cook as Mary Lisbon, Leslie Heyman as Therese Lisbon, and Chelsea Swain as Bonnie Lisbon. So five young blonde girls in Michigan, all of whom are doomed. This is told from the point of view of four men who were teenage boys when the girls died. They were always close to their social circle within their realm without ever being able to actually get too close, and crucially without ever being able to understand who the girls were and where they came from. Like I said, Cecilia is the first of the sisters to die. She attempts to slit her wrists. One of the first scenes is a doctor telling her, you don't know how lucky you are to be alive, and you don't know how bad life can truly get. And she says, well, doctor, clearly you've never been a 13-year-old girl. the girls have these overprotective Catholic parents played by James Woods and Kathleen Turner. James Woods is one of the teachers at their high school. He chaperones the dance that the girls go to, and he is the one who Tripp Fontaine is able to successfully convince to let his daughters go out to the dance with him and with three other random guys who end up being the students who are the narrators of this film. Reporters show up to the girl's house for information after the first sister commits suicide and the mother kicks them out. But notably, the girls don't really seem all that fazed by Cecilia's suicide. It is more about the boys' fascination with the sisters, even as they are letting this seemingly roll off their back. This is where we meet Tripp Fontaine, Josh Hartnett's character, this heartthrob who all of the girls in school are in love with except for Lux, according to the narrator. That certainly changes as he successfully woos Lux and then convinces her dad to allow all the girls to go to the dance, abandons Lux asleep on the high school football field the morning after having sex with her. We get this interview with the older Tripp Fontaine in which he says that he didn't care how she got home after that and everything had been different. The girls are severely punished for Lux breaking curfew. All of their contact with the outside world is taken away from them. The doors are locked. The blinds are shut. They are entirely shut in by themselves. Their parents make Lux burn her vinyls, or just one of them, because it smokes up the entire house and they're just content sort of throwing the rest of them away. Lux continues to rebel by just starting to sleep with random men on the roof of the house, which the boys are like watching from across the street with their telescope. The city attempts to cut down a tree in the girls' yard, and they go out to try and stop the removal of this tree, futile as the tree is cut down anyway. In the midst of this particularly harsh punishment, when the girls are not allowed to go outside at all, the boys attempt to rescue them by going to their house and speaking with them, and Lux convinces them to come inside and makes it seem like, you know, they're going to go to this place together where they can have experiences and live their lives free of these overbearing Catholic parents. But as the boys try to help them escape, they realize that the girls have already died in a suicide pact with one another, and all four of them commit suicide on the same night. And the deaths of these girls haunt the boys forever. The town is stunned for a few weeks, but ultimately goes back to normal. You don't hear so much about the suicides anymore after a few months, aside for a passing reference or so. The mystery of the girls and the fact they were never fully able to put together everything that happened haunts these boys for the rest of their lives.
You guys, I think, have both touched on, like, the kind of like the dreamlike elements of it, I think, are really impressive, because it's this weird thing of, it's a real like unreality to it all. Like, it all feels quite magical. Whereas obviously Rapwell, there's like the cringe reality of being young. And I think, obviously, there's a lot to, you know, growing up in a middle-class family versus more of a working-class family, growing up a girl versus growing up a boy, growing up with parents who are religious and smothery and overprotective versus parents who are going to Puerto Rico, yeah, there is done. The Virgin Suicides is such a roadmap for films like Janet Planet and like other films like that, where it's navigating this like thorny, difficult time that feels like semi-magical, but also is obviously like very sad and horrific at its heart.
James Woods was an odd choice for this. Admittedly, I'm not familiar with his human acting as much as
I know him from Family Guy.
Yeah, I haven't seen him in a lot of. I haven't seen him.
Roles where he's not chasing a trail of candy.
Yeah, exactly. But he was actually very kind of sweet, but like there is this sinister undertone with him. But his wife is really, she's the star of the whole problem show.
James Woods is interesting because, like, especially now that he's this, like, right-wing QAnon crank piece of shit, it's like, going back to look at him in, like, roles from the 80s and 90s, it's like, in this one especially, I mean, he's playing this, like, overbearing father, but, like, at the same time, you kind of get the sense that, like, he's being dominated a little bit by his wife, played by Kathleen Turner, and also his religion. So it's like, he feels like a very conflicted man who, I feel like, especially in this suburb with these angsty teenagers who all end up killing themselves, it's like that feels like symbolic of a specific generation of American man. And I think back to like 1986 with Videodrome too, and another role where I think he's playing this character who is very representative of that decade in business and television and entrepreneurship and this embrace of Reaganism. It's because that's a movie about showing essentially snuff films on live TV to boost ratings, and he is this executive all about like chasing the dollar at all costs, and that ends up costing him his humanity. So I feel like you can almost view James Woods' career as a sort of performance art, but this is one of a few movies where I am particularly partial to him, and I think he did give a very good performance.
It's a tough watch for most of it, just kind of knowing where it's going. Because, like, they immediately tell you that these girls are all going to kill themselves. So you're just kind of watching with this impending dread, which is, like, it makes it really hard to enjoy the love story. It makes it really hard to, like, feel that much for, like, the group of boys, like, at the time. Just because you know, like, it's you don't buy in. You don't get emotionally invested because it kind of immediately tells you not to, which is interesting. You watch the girls with a sense of horror that, like, you would only have if you didn't know that that was going to happen and you were watching this a second time. It's an interesting framing because it's with these high school movies always, like, you know, you kind of, you can see yourself in all these characters, like, at like in any of these movies that we're talking about. But in this one, I kind of didn't feel that for the other, like, for the boys, just because there were, like, tragedies in my town that I don't really want to get too into. But, like, there was, like, a family that died, and it was very disturbing. But that's the closest thing that I had to, you know, to this kind of experience. Nobody really knew them, like, they were younger, so, like, it wasn't my age. But it's just, I imagine that people that were that age probably could relate to these kids, but, like, that specifically is, like, really, I don't know, it's hard to imagine what you would do at that age with something like this happening. So it's, like, the movie itself is really good, very well written. I'm just saying, like, from a point of relating to the characters, I would think that I would have a more pleasant's not a fair word, because it's a very good movie, and I don't want to say it needs to be a pleasant watch and enjoyable watch or whatever, but I think that it would just be a little bit more, I don't know. What's the word I'm looking for? Do you know what I mean?
I think I do know what you mean. I think it's sort of like operating on hard mode, where I feel like one of the strengths of this movie is the fact that I'm still able to connect emotionally with characters, and I'm still able to, like, immerse myself into the story, even though we're told from the very get-go that all of these sisters end up committing suicide. It's like, you feel like that could certainly be a cause for, like, a lapse in dramatic tension where you might not be able to get as invested into this movie. So I feel like that really goes to show how strong the storytelling is and the cinematography and especially the writing. I mean, we talked about the, like, adaptation of the novel already. I thought the bits and pieces that she chooses to keep within the narration is beautiful, honestly. It's it's really so
that line
well done.
It sticks with me where the adult Trip Fontaine calls Lux Lisbon the still point in a turning world. Which is beautiful. That then leads to him, you know, going back to his group therapy session or whatever it is, AA or something. And they're very clearly hitting you over the head with how much this has affected the people that knew them later on. And then they go on to show you the immediate effect of, like, them running out of the house and never really being able to feel whole. And it's operating on hard mode is a very good way to put it, because it's like you kind of can't hate the parents. Because it's like they didn't think that they were really doing anything wrong. You can be upset that they didn't fix the way that they were parenting these kids after, you know, Cecilia. Like, you can't hate them. They're not good, but they're not doing anything actually malevolent or intentionally malevolent. You can't be upset with the girls. Like, you can call them selfish, I guess, in the way that suicide can be seen as selfish. But that's really kind of cold. It's hard to pin down exactly, you know, what you should feel other than just grief, you know, after this. It makes you think about, like, how parenting like this affects not just those kids, also just the community. I mean, now the community has to deal with whatever comes from having a family go through this, like, within, you know, it's not just something that affects them. So it's interesting.
And the fact that the community is able to brush this off so easily and to eventually just stop talking about it entirely, unless it's like right. in passing reference, I think is one of the right. most telling things about the movie and like what it has to say about American society and the suburbs, especially like to the extent that, you know, even having an entire family of young girls all commit suicide, you know, isn't enough to get people to sort of snap out of the ennui of like living in this town and in this state and in this country, I suppose. That to me is one of the most like hard-hitting moments in the movie. Edward Lachman, the same cinematographer as Carol, he creates this feeling of teenage angst approaching the unknowable loneliness and togetherness all at once and seclusion in this Michigan town. When the narrator says at the end that it didn't matter that the Lisbon sisters were girls, I don't think that that's particularly true. Girls are treated differently by their peers, by society and overbearing parents. They'd have never been shut into this house with zero contact with the outside world if they were boys and this happened to them. The fascination that these boys have with the Lisbon girls is because of the mystery surrounding them and the constant feeling that they'll never truly know the whole story. But in romanticizing them to this extent, they fail to see them as people and are unable to recognize that the events leading to their deaths are already in motion. This is an incredible film. I'm really glad that Molly brought it to the podcast. She actually had to leave a couple minutes ago, so you aren't hearing her again.
Thank you
is
so much
why.
For coming on, Molly.
Yeah, thanks, Molly. Sorry we ran long. So much. We did run a little bit long. Brody, you have to get out of here as well, actually. So that is going to do it for us this week on the podcast. If you are not familiar with the Mudville Patreon yet, you can access that at patreon.com/Mudville. Sign up for free to receive updates anytime we release new content, whether that is an episode on the main feed or an episode of Mudville at the Movies or one of our written lists or articles. A lot of good stuff coming out there soon. We thank you guys so much for spending the time with us today. We thank Molly for being our guest on this episode and bringing us two wonderful movies to talk about. We hope you all enjoyed the conversation about Connor O'Malley's Rap World and Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides. That is going to do it for us on the podcast this week. This has been Mudville, and I have been one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
I'm your other host, Brody Staub. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks, and, Molly, for coming on again.
And we will see you all next week.